the Psychedologist.
Welcome back to Psychedelic Summer School, everybody. Students and teachers, Psychedelic Summer School is a mini audio series of brief overviews of topics related to the use of psychedelics. These are weekly 15 to 20 minute quick and dirty installments on topics like intention setting, substances, holding space, harm reduction, dealing with difficult experiences, safety, cognitive liberty, historical uses of entheogens, and this week's episode, current research. We're joined by Amy Romanello, recent graduate of Northeastern University, who is going on to do big and beautiful things in the field of cognitive neuroscience and perhaps more. She's been an active part of Students for Sensible Drug Policy at Northeastern, also one of the founding contributors of Boston Entheogenic Network, and I'm grateful for all of the collaboration that she's done with me and with others in the Boston community for psychedelic people. Without further ado, here is a little bit about current research going on in psychedelic science. Hey, everybody. Thanks for checking out Psychedelic Summer School. This is week 4, and we are going to learn about substances with Amy. Hi, Amy. Thanks for being on the show.
Hi, Leah. Thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure to be on your podcast. And yeah, we're going to talk a little bit about sort of the current landscape of psychedelic science right now. And so most of what I'm going to talk about focuses mainly on what's stemming from research in North and South America. Although I do talk a little bit about research in the UK, but just sort of as a disclaimer, certainly the things I'm talking about are not exhaustive because there is so much happening right now. So yeah, I think we can talk a little bit about one of my personal favorites, which would be LSD. And as most of your listeners may know, there's a really rich history of LSD and its use within the treatment relating to research, relating to psychedelic research, and as well as the neuroscience research. In the past few years, however, we've seen a shift away from using LSD or LSD-assisted psychotherapy in a sort of clinical research realm, and we've seen sort of a new focus on the neuroscience of LSD and research relating to that. Specifically, we can talk about, of course, the big study by the Beckley Foundation in 2016. Did you hear about that one, Leah, relating to resting state networks?
The most I heard about it was that the neuroimaging done in that was like named by the Science magazine as the most important science research that happened that year.
Yeah, I was actually, funny enough, I was living in the Czech Republic at the time that it came out, and it was just sort of like this this great experience to be living where, you know, Stanislav Grof was once, you know, working with LSD and developing holotropic breathwork. Then to read this study that came out, which is actually the first neuroimaging study using LSD ever, and the Beckley Foundation, which the program that they were focused on there was at Imperial College London, because they've got several different, you know, work groups all over the world. But the folks at Imperial College were looking at the effects of LSD on neural activity. And specifically, they, you know, one of the most amazing things to me was all the information they could find relating to LSD's effects on resting state networks, specifically the default mode network, which is really implicated in us being wakeful and conscious. So there's a lot of really interesting information there to delve deeper into and discover if you have the time to read that paper. There was also some of the clinical research with LSD. You know, it's still there, hasn't gone away. in 2014, there was a study with LSD-assisted psychotherapy for advanced stage cancer patients, which is sort of a paying homage to the history of what LSD was traditionally studied for. And one the sort of the most amazing thing to me from that study was the fact that after experiencing this treatment with LSD, patients were noted to have changes in both their trait and state-based anxiety, which suggests that there was actually a change in more sort of rigid parts of the participant's personality, which is not necessarily something that's really discussed or documented often in terms of psychedelic research, which definitely is appealing to me in terms of someone who's really interested in personality disorders. So if we move on to a substance that is maybe a little bit more in the limelight right now, we can talk about MDMA, which of course, there is MAPS and their phase three trials that are underway in some places and raring to go in some other locations around the U.S. And I guess maybe I should talk a little bit about what that is. So MAPS is doing right now, they're starting their phase three study using MDMA assisted psychotherapy to treat PTSD. And so they, prior to beginning this study, they actually were granted, MDMA was granted a breakthrough therapy status by the FDA, meaning that basically after all this work that Rick Doblin and MAPS have been doing to build a relationship with the FDA and the DEA, finally they have said, you know, we're going to continue to work with you and hopefully see the efficient completion of your phase three study.
And so, I think with breakthrough medicine, it's also like, this is so good. The results look so good that we want to expedite getting this out to the people because the need is urgent and it like can definitely be met by this medicine. I think it means that too.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is, I think, a great accomplishment to, especially, you know, with all of the history and sort of disagreement with the FDA, to have them give this breakthrough therapy status is such a great, you know, stepping stone in the right direction. And then, of course, other than, you know, MDMA is really being focused on treating trauma-based disorders, and PTSD, of course, falls into that. But it's not the only patient population that it can benefit. In particular, a study that was completed, I think, just last year, I don't think the data is even published yet, was a study out of UCLA with Alicia Danforth and Charlie Grobe, where they were looking at the treatment of social anxiety in autistic adults using MDMA assisted psychotherapy. And of course, important to just make the distinction that the MDMA treatment was not focusing on treating autism. It was focused on treating social anxiety, which is often a common occurrence in adults who do have autism. And so, you know, we're looking at all these different patient populations, and there's so much to be learned from looking at the implementation of psychedelics in the clinical realm. But running parallel to that is sort of a different track within psychedelic science relating to looking at how these substances affect the brain. And so since the beginning of 2018, so just in the past 6 months, there have been more than 20 peer-reviewed publications discussing and investigating further the safety of MDMA, the mechanisms of action, as well as the subjective effects of MDMA in a whole range of patient populations. So it's really clear that we're not just looking at how these substances affect people who are getting treatment within clinical trials. We're also looking at how these substances are going to affect people in sort of the most intimate way, right, their brain. So we can switch a little bit because MDMA, like as most people probably understand, it can be a little bit different than traditional psychedelics, or at least people who may have had their own experiences with all these different substances. MDMA is not necessarily the same as psychedelics like LSD and psilocybin. And so sort of it's not a surprise that running parallel to the research with MDMA, we also see psilocybin, which has sort of taken a forefront in this realm because traditional psychedelic like LSD has sort of taken a little bit of a back burner and is more being focused in the realm of neuroscience research. Psilocybin, which has some of the same effects, yet in a more compact time frame during its course of action, has sort of fallen more into mainstream, if you will. We're seeing things like a ballot initiative in California to hopefully change the scheduling of psilocybin in California. So it's definitely entered the mainstream atmosphere.
And so what you're saying is when you take shrooms, you don't trip for as long as acid. So it's more favorable for a therapeutic study.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it was at Horizons last year when someone asked a question relating to that. And the researcher's response was, you know, could you imagine a therapy session that lasted 8 to 12 hours, which is what, I mean, hey, that might be amazing, right? Which is sort of the duration of LSD, typically 8 to 12 hours. But in terms of medicalizing this model and sort of making it the most feasible for the current structure of medicine, an 8 to 12 hour therapy session might not be the best option, even just in terms of getting insurance to cover these things later down the line. So, you know, my understanding is that psilocybin, because it does produce some of the similar effects psychologically, within that 4 to 6 hour time frame, it's much more feasible for, you know, being a tool within psychotherapy.
Yeah, I feel like people also, as they become more open to psychedelics, they're more likely to be open to something that grows naturally than something made in a lab. Even though we love pharmaceuticals, we love them.
Right, exactly. And that's definitely true. You know, psilocybin, of course, is something coming from Mother Earth. Whereas, you know, I can argue LSD, you know, you can be extracted from ergot, but you know, that's being done in the lab. There is a synthesis that's happening chemically. So of course, psilocybin is different. And, you know, the traditional work with psilocybin that has happened historically has been looking to treat patients with, you know, terminal illness or advanced stage cancer. And within that patient population, oftentimes anxiety and depression are very prevalent. And so the treatment with psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy is geared towards ameliorating some of that distress. And there's sort of two big, I don't want to call them powerhouses, but there's two big foundations that are really focusing on psilocybin, and one of them being the Hefter Institute, which is focusing more on the clinical application of psilocybin within psychotherapy. And then we have, of course, the Beckley Foundation, working mostly in the area of neuroscience. And one of their studies that came out just a few years ago, 4 years ago, which was really sort of innovative to me, was comparing MDMA and psilocybin and the effects that each substance had on brain activity, especially with resting state networks. And so that, to me, was really pivotal because I'd never seen a study that compared two different substances before. So from that study comparing MDMA to psilocybin, the results show that psilocybin had a greater increase, or the patients who were given psilocybin showed a greater increase in connectivity between several of the resting state networks that they were observing versus patients who had been given MDMA. I don't have a list of the resting state networks that they did focus on, but I know the Beckley Foundation traditionally looks specifically at the default mode network, the central executive network as well. And in their previous studies, it's usually about 10 or 15 resting state networks. So they're really looking at a global region of the brain.
Okay.
And then, like I mentioned, the Hefter Institute is focusing a little bit more on the clinical application of psilocybin. And so in the last 6 years alone, they have come out with, I think, 5 to 6 studies looking at psilocybin-assisted psychotherapy in the treatment of cancer patients with sort of end-of-life distress or anxiety. And that's just, I think, a point to note because there is so much research going on. And yes, we are seeing things like MDMA in the news and, you know, articles all over conservative and more liberal sources. But there's no way that the media could focus on all the research that's being done because there's just so much of it. And psilocybin in particular, I see at least psilocybin and MDMA as being sort of the two substances that are the most in the mainstream right now. But that doesn't go to discredit the other work that's being done with plant medicine, because there is a lot of that as well, which I think is a great way for us to talk a little bit about both ayahuasca and ibogaine or iboga. Because oftentimes I think the medicalization of psychedelic science, and psychedelic, you know, treatment with psychedelics is focusing on substances that can be synthesized in, a lab, and that there's merit to that, but there's also, I think, merit to looking at all of the data that we have and all of the experiences that have been had for thousands of years in indigenous cultures throughout Africa, South America. We can't just not talk about them. And so with ayahuasca in particular, I think there's been a little bit of a, I don't want to say resurgence. I think there's been a little bit of a shift towards focusing on the potential of ayahuasca in treating different trauma-based disorders, actually at Beyond Psychedelics, which I think we might have a little bit of time to talk about later. Rachel Nielsen, who presented at Horizons 2 years ago about this study as well, has just completed her study looking at ayahuasca, people's experiences with ayahuasca in the treatment of PTSD. So she did a survey-based study where she gathered data from basically anyone who could fill out and actually complete the survey. And I'm really excited to see when she publishes all of the results, what we can gain, because there is so much to be gained, you know, not just from clinical research, but also from observational and survey-based studies as well. Besides PTSD, ayahuasca is also being, or ayahuasca-assisted psychotherapy is being considered and examined for the treatment of grief. So there was a study in, I want to say, Mexico. I believe Mexico, that compared the ayahuasca-assisted psychotherapy to traditional sort of group and peer support networks. And that, I think, is a great way to look at an alternative use for psychedelic assisted psychotherapy, because so far what we've been discussing has solely been patients who maybe have had treatment resistance to traditional pharmaceuticals and traditional modalities within psychotherapy. But when you look at a population of people who have experienced grief in their life, maybe they don't suffer themselves from, you know, a diagnosed mental illness, but there are aspects of our lives that in which we react to things in healthy ways and sometimes in not so healthy ways. And so I think looking at grief is a way to focus on patient populations that are maybe relatively healthy, but are experiencing this trigger in their life, which they cannot, you know, heal from and move past until something more drastic and actually a treatment that can actually focus on the root causes of their distress. I don't know. I think that is really innovative. And I'm interested in learning more about other patient populations that might not necessarily be considered mentally ill. And you can't see me, but I'm doing quotes around that because there are so many other populations of patients and realms of which this type of work could be beneficial.
And Dr. Adele LaFrance was looking into ayahuasca for eating disorders as well.
Yeah, and that's something that I'm really looking forward to reading more about and just learning more about, because if anything, I think in some of the work that I have been doing and looking at all these different studies, ayahuasca seems to be not necessarily the most understood. And because of that, there is so much research going on, not only in the clinical realm, but also in the neuroscience realm. The Beckley Foundation, again, keep hearing that name. They're also working with ayahuasca, and they, in 2015, did a study looking at we're looking at resting state networks because they're implicated in consciousness. But the results from their study really stand out with me. And mainly they pointed out that the patients or the participants who had received ayahuasca and then undergone neuroimaging showed a reduction in activity of the frontal cortex. And so they hypothesized that potentially this reduction in activity from the frontal cortex is sort of the loosening of cognitive constraints, allowing participants to sort of have that the surfacing and processing of trauma that is usually suppressed by your natural fight or flight response. So I'm really excited to see in the next 5-10 years where the use of ayahuasca is in sort of the Western world. And also it's important to note that I'm interested to see and follow how the integration of these practices from indigenous cultures and are integrated, because that we could do a whole podcast about the shortcomings of that right now. And so I'm interested to see where that goes in the future. And I think that sort of bridges right into what we've been talking about in terms of the future prospects of psychedelic science, because when we talk about iboga or ibogaine assisted psychotherapy, it's something that does have a rich history within both the indigenous tribes in Africa, but also within the 50s and 60s in the United States. I'm trying to find here. This was his name, Howard Lotsoff, who is attributed to doing a lot of work with ibogaine within his sort of social circle and with himself to treat his own opioid dependence. I don't think we would be where we are today in terms of looking at Ibogaine within this model without the work that Howard Lotsoff did. And of course, without the rich history and all of the information that we can gain and that needs to be considered from traditional practices in Africa and elsewhere. In terms of current research, most with Ibogaine is looking at substance dependence, in particular opioid dependence. It seems that researchers don't necessarily have an answer as to why Ibogaine treatment for opioid dependence is so successful in terms of reducing craving and withdrawal symptoms completely to, you know, sustaining abstinence from the, you know, substance in a 12-month follow-up even. And in this last year, in 2018, in 2018, two of the studies were published that MAPS was sponsoring, and they were two observational studies looking at Ibogaine treatment. They were both published in the American Journal of Drug and Alcohol Abuse, and one was looking at treatment in Mexico at an independent center in Mexico as well as New Zealand. So both of these studies weren't actually giving patients Ibogaine. They weren't doing the treatment themselves. They were reviewing data from two different independent centers. And although, you know, we're talking about Mexico and New Zealand that are not necessarily associated with each other geographically, so there's, of course, different environmental factors that affected the study. But what's important is that both of the studies highlighted very similar results, emphasizing the success of Ibogaine treatment in a lot of factors, like I mentioned, reducing drug craving, reducing drug use, and completely ameliorating withdrawal symptoms, even in the 1 to 2 month follow-up. So if anything, I think what this says about Ibogaine is that there is, we're seeing these really robust results. And that is leading us to the need for more research, especially in terms of safety and efficacy and in the neuroscientific realm, which is definitely happening. I mean, in the past 2 years, there's been a shift in the sort of realm of Ibogaine research, focusing on safety and efficacy, looking at case studies, specifically trying to figure out what's going on with some participants in research who experience really severe cardiac implications, and sort of figuring out why these things are going on, which without that really necessary investigation in terms of a scientific realm relating to Ibogaine, we're not going to see an advancement of treatment with Ibogaine. I think they both go hand in hand. So I think that also parallels the entire body of research that I've been discussing. We see so much with all these different substances, including ketamine, which I don't think I have enough time to talk about. But we're seeing all of this research going on, both in the realm of clinical research, looking at how can we heal these traumas, how can we heal all these different types of illnesses that are plaguing our society, but also how do these substances work? Why are they successful in treating so many different things? And what can we learn about them in terms of knowledge that then can be implemented in treatment? I think that we're going to see going forward a larger sort of intermingling of those two realms, because as we try to medicalize and create this sort of pocket for psychedelics within modern medicine and modern psychiatry, In order for those things to be successful and mainstreamed, I think both aspects of the neuroscience and the scientific knowledge, as well as the clinical use and the clinical treatment, have to grow and develop together.
Mm. Wow. Thank you so much, Amy.
My pleasure. I love talking about this stuff. So
I love hearing about it, and I appreciate anyone who supports psychedelic research. You know, we all get to think about a future where psychedelics aren't prohibited anymore and where people that need them can get access to them. And it's because of the legitimate research taking place. So thank you to all those people as well.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm honored to walk the earth with so many people who are fighting this fight.
I'm honored to walk the earth with you.
Ditto. It's reciprocated.
That's all today, children. Tune in next week to The Psychedologist for more Psychedelic Summer School.